Hello, listeners, and welcome back to In Summation, The Final Word, a podcast for inquisitive minds on real courtroom drama. I'm your host, Paul Townsend, flying solo today after co-hosting the show last week with my colleague and friend, Bob Gottlieb. I do want to say a special thank you to everyone who reached out with feedback from last week's episode. It was the first time I brought on a co-host, and I could not have been happier with the discussion I had with Bob Gottlieb about the Korematsu Supreme Court case. And from what I have read, you all enjoyed it as well. In this show, we're going to look a bit more in depth at the decision and consequences of representing oneself at trial. We're going to dig into the manner in which a witness is questioned and how that impacts the jury. We'll talk a little bit about standing to contest a search and discuss the policy implications surrounding a defendant's mental illness, even if it doesn't present an affirmative defense. And we're going to clear up some ambiguities regarding serial killers and how they're prosecuted. The individual who's the focus of today's show is famous for the shocking and horrifying ways that he took lives. Despite having been put to death by the government in 1989, he remains a household name, and his criminal accolades have long survived him. He's been the subject of countless movies, documentaries, books, both fiction and nonfiction, as well as news articles. And despite his prolific body of criminal activity, he was only convicted of 3 murders, though prior to his death, he confessed to around 30, and most accounts put the number significantly higher than that. We won't have the time today to go through all 3 trials that he underwent, but we're going to focus on the most significant, while still mentioning the other 2, as they're obviously relevant. This is the state of Florida versus Ted Bundy. Theodore Robert Bundy, who went by Ted, is unquestioningly a fascinating character in American culture. His name conjures fear and loathing for what he did to mostly college-aged women all over the United States. As I noted before, there is a wealth of materials on the life and death of Ted Bundy, and everything in between. But I want to caution all the listeners about them. For instance, there was a popular Netflix movie about Ted Bundy starring Zac Efron. I've seen it. Having researched a bit about Bundy's exploits, I can tell you that the movie takes some real liberties in some of the most important aspects. To give one example, the show merges 2 separate trials into 1 just to save time and move the story along. So the majority of the climactic courtroom scene is completely inaccurate and doesn't really capture what happened. So as with all the cases we dive into on this podcast, be very careful with the cultural consumption if you're looking to get an honest and straightforward account of what really happened in these court cases. Ted Bundy was actually born Theodore Robert Cowell on November 24th, 1946, to Eleanor Louise Cowell in Burlington, Vermont. His father's identity has never been confirmed. From birth until he was 3, he lived with his maternal grandparents in Philadelphia and was raised as though his mother was his older sister. In 1950, Ted and his mother have moved in with Eleanor's cousins in Tacoma, Washington. And the following year, Eleanor married Johnny Culpepper Bundy, who formally adopted Ted. Despite Johnny's efforts to bond with him, the boy remained distant and never viewed Johnny as his father. Accounts of Bundy's childhood are scattered and often contradictory. Over the course of his life, he gave several interviews making claims about his upbringing that were incongruous with other claims that he made in other interviews. What we do know is that before the age of 18, he was arrested twice on suspicion of burglary and auto theft, but when he turned 18, the details of all incidents were expunged from his record. After graduating high school in 1965, Bundy spent 1 year at the University of Puget Sound. He then transferred to the University of Washington for his sophomore year, and then dropped out. He had had a serious girlfriend at the time, whose name has been obscured in records for her privacy and protection, but who most accounts refer to as Stephanie Brooks. When Bundy dropped out of college and took up some menial work, including working for Nelson Rockefeller's presidential campaign, she dumped him for lacking ambition and drive. Bundy took this rejection especially hard, leaving Washington and eventually heading to Philadelphia, where he ultimately spent a semester at Temple University. By the fall of 1969, Bundy had returned to Washington State. He met a woman named Elizabeth Klopfer, the woman who would prove to maintain essentially the one relationship that Bundy had for the majority of his life. Spurred by his relationship with Klopfer, Bundy re-enrolled at the University of Washington. He majored in psychology and graduated with honors. In 1972, after graduating college, Bundy worked in Republican politics, joining the re-election campaign for Washington Governor Daniel Evans. He was well-liked and given lots of responsibility. Ironically, he was even appointed to the Seattle Crime Prevention Advisory Committee. He took the law school entrance exam, known as the LSAT, and powered by recommendation letters from the governor and other high-ranking officials, he was accepted to a few law schools. He enrolled in the law school at the University of Puget Sound. Throughout his life, Bundy was a sociopath. He lacked empathy. He did not care about the feelings of others. And perhaps the best example of this behavior is seen through some of his actions during law school. I previously mentioned that he was dating a woman that we'll call Stephanie Brooks, who broke his heart when she dumped him for being an aimless youth. In law school, Bundy was still dating Elizabeth Klopfer. However, he also reached back out to Brooks in the fall of 1973. She was impressed with his connections to high-ranking government officials and his law school enrollment. He began to date Brooks again while still dating Klopfer, and needless to say, the two women did not know about each other. Brooks came to Seattle several times to visit him over weekends and for extended stays. Bundy pushed the relationship hard and discussed marriage with her. Brooks became enthralled that Bundy had addressed the one serious concern she had about him. She became enthusiastic about moving to the next level. Bundy introduced her to a man named Ross Davis, who was the chairman of the Washington State Republican Committee, as his fiancé. In January 1974, Bundy abruptly broke off all contact with Brooks. He stopped answering her calls. He stopped writing to her. She tried for weeks to get a hold of him and thought something had happened to him. When she finally got him on the phone a month later, she asked why he had decided to end their relationship. In a voice devoid of any emotion, he responded, "Stephanie, I have no idea what you mean," and hung up. In interviews later in his life, he confessed that he had engineered the whole relationship with Brooks with the goal of getting her to want to marry him and then dumping her as revenge for her breaking up with him as a teenager in 1968. That pretty much sums up how Bundy felt about nearly every relationship he ever had, except for Elizabeth Klopfer. Now, there's much lost to history about when or where Bundy first started killing women. The only accounts really come from Bundy himself, who was notoriously unreliable and inconsistent when speaking in interviews later in his life. It may be that he really didn't remember, or maybe ultimately the timelines got confused because he had engaged in so many murders. Or it may be that he enjoyed the power of being the only one who actually knew the truth and just wanted to hold on to that. For the purposes of this podcast, we don't have time to go into all the known victims of Bundy's serial killings. But let's discuss for a minute just how Bundy operated and what his victimology was. Bundy's victims were young women, typically attractive, usually in college or at least college-aged. I'm going to assume that most listeners here are familiar with the concept of serial killers, but maybe don't have an in-depth understanding of how they typically mature. What we find with most people who we describe as serial killers is that when they begin, they're disorganized, crude, and inexperienced. As they continue down their path, they learn, they become more efficient, and they develop their own specific methodology. this is one of the things that separates Bundy from some of the other serial killers and why he's such a fixture. From the earliest known victims, Bundy was already very proficient. He did progress with regard to his modus operandi or methodology in terms of how he chose his victims, how he got them somewhere private, and how he killed them, but he didn't have that original frenzied crime scenes that left evidence that ultimately led to a number of serial killers getting caught later on. Bundy never used guns, as he was afraid of the noise and the forensic evidence that gunshots produce. Instead, he opted for either blunt force trauma from common objects or strangulation, both of which could be accomplished without leaving much evidence behind. There were basically two methods which Bundy employed once he had selected a victim. When he was first starting out, he would typically forcibly break into a residence late at night and attack his victims with a blunt weapon, often something he found in the home. Later on, as he matured, he would lure his victims to secluded areas where he had pre-planted a weapon, typically a crowbar, and he would use that to kill women. Sometimes, to aid in his ruse, he feigned an injury. He would wear a plaster cast on his arm or a leg. He used crutches and then would ask for assistance carrying something to his car. This was made easier by the fact that Ted Bundy was a very handsome and charming man. He was good-looking, had an ease about him, which put other people at ease. Once he had them at his car, he would bludgeon them and then transport them to a pre-selected secondary site that was very private. There, he would strangle his victims while sexually assaulting them. All of Bundy's victims were white women, nearly all between the ages of 15 and 25, and again, most were college students. We're going to briefly discuss his first trial. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, as the second trial is what Bundy is really known for. But on August 16th, 1975, a very astute Utah Highway Patrol officer named Bob Hayward noticed Bundy cruising around a residential area very early in the morning. Bundy was driving a Volkswagen Beetle and had removed the front passenger seat. As soon as Bundy saw the patrol car following him, he fled and Hayward gave chase. When Hayward finally managed to stop Bundy's car, he had a ski mask, crowbar, handcuffs, coil of rope, ice pick, trash bags, and gloves in the vehicle. Hayward thought that these were burglary tools, but didn't have enough evidence to detain Bundy, so he was released from custody, though law enforcement put 24-hour surveillance on him. Bundy then began to get nervous and sold his Volkswagen Beetle. The moment that that transaction was done, the police approached the buyer, a teenager, and persuaded him to allow the FBI to search the car, which he did. This provides us with a good opportunity to discuss when the police or the FBI can conduct a search without a search warrant, which is an issue that comes up over and over again in criminal law. We all know our Fourth Amendment rights, but law enforcement cannot subject our persons, property, or effects to unreasonable searches and seizures without a search warrant. Over time, this protection has been extended to cars on the theory that a person has a reasonable expectation in the privacy of one's vehicle, and therefore law enforcement needs a warrant to search it. Consequently, a police officer cannot search a person's vehicle without a warrant unless certain circumstances apply. The first is consent. If you are the lawful occupant of an apartment or the owner of a car, and you provide consent for law enforcement to conduct a search, then there is no need for them to get a warrant. They'll typically have a form which they can have you fill out and sign, making it very clear that you are providing consent, so that you can't later come back and claim that you never gave consent for a search of your car or apartment, should law enforcement find anything incriminating. Other exigent circumstances may apply. A police officer is allowed to conduct a basic search of a person during an arrest to make sure they don't have any weapons on them. There are some other available exigent circumstances that law enforcement can utilize, but we don't need to get too technical for the purposes of this podcast. You just need to know that in general, cops can't search your property without a warrant. Warrants require probable cause. Cops can't go to the district attorney or the U.S. attorney and say, "My gut tells me this guy has drugs or guns or some other illegal contraband in his car." That doesn't fly. The cops have to have a concrete basis for the belief that the search will yield actual evidence of a crime. That's why the cops could not search Bundy's car. They couldn't produce probable cause that they would find anything related to an actual crime in it, even though by this time, they actually think that he's involved in some kidnappings and assaults. But then they got lucky. Bundy sold his car. As Bundy is no longer the owner of the car, he no longer has a reasonable expectation of privacy in the vehicle, and therefore he cannot contest the consent given by the new owner. To claim that a search was unlawful, the person must have something called standing. Standing essentially means that the person who's complaining about the search is the person whose rights were violated. If an illegal search of someone else's car uncovered evidence of your crime, you cannot personally attack the search because you lack the standing to contest it. Let's do a quick example of this and then move on. Let's say that Mike Scavelli robs a bank. He gets a duffel bag full of cash, runs out of the bank. He's excited, he's sweating, the cops are on the scene, and he wants to get away. Mike runs into an old parking garage nearby, where he has stashed a fresh set of clothing. He changes clothes, puts his old clothes in the duffel bag with the money and a weapon in the trunk of a random BMW M4 owned by Matt Evans. Mike and Matt have never met. Mike just figured that he could come back and retrieve the bag from the car later, as the car looks like it was never driven. When everything is calmed down, Mike intends to come back, reopen the trunk of the M4, take the duffel bag out, and leave the scene as though nothing ever happened. Ideally, the owner of the M4, Matt, would never know. But let's say Matt has three unpaid parking tickets, and one cop at the local police station, Officer Jeff Palmer, knows where Matt parks his car. Officer Palmer goes, finds the car, and just decides to search it. He pops open the trunk without a warrant, and finds the duffel bag with the money, clothing, gun, dye packs from the bank, the whole shebang. They DNA test the clothing, and it comes back to Mike. Mike is now arrested. Mike is understandably upset that the cops illegally searched the car and found evidence of his bank robbery, but since Mike has no reasonable expectation of privacy in Matt's car, he cannot contest the search. Okay, back to Bundy. Now that he's sold the car, the police could get consent to search from the new teenaged owner, and they do. They find hairs in the car, matching women named Melissa Smith and Carol DeRanche, who had been kidnapped and assaulted but couldn't identify their assailant. Keep in mind, this is the mid-1970s, so this was not a DNA comparison. They were compared under microscopes and determined to be a match with the best available technology at the time. Bundy was ultimately put in a lineup, and DeRanche actually was able to identify him as a man who was posed as a police officer, abducted, and assaulted her. Because of the negative publicity he was getting in the community, Bundy waived a jury and proceeded to a bench trial, meaning that the judge decided guilt or innocence. He was convicted of assault and kidnapping and was sentenced to 1 to 15 years in a Utah state prison. While in Utah, Bundy was transferred to Colorado, where he had been indicted for a murder. He elected to represent himself. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. During a preliminary hearing in Colorado, he asked to be allowed to use the law library to research his case at lunch. While there, he went behind a stack of books, which obscured the view of the guards who were looking at him. He opened a window, jumped out, and was on the lam for 6 days before he was caught and brought back to court. Despite indications that his case was actually going well, and against the advice of literally everyone who he knew who had told him to stay put, he escaped again on December 30th, 1977. He carved a hole in his cell ceiling using a smuggled-in hacksaw. The hole broke into the warden's apartment, which was located just above his cell, where he raided the man's wardrobe and took off for Chicago. Through a series of stolen cars and bus rides, Bundy ended up through Chicago into Tallahassee, where he arrived January 8, 1978. Here we get into the events leading up to the second trial. In the early morning hours of January 15, 1978, Bundy went to the Florida State University campus, and entered the Chi Omega sorority house through a back door that didn't lock correctly. Just before 3 a.m., he beat Margaret Bowman with a piece of firewood before he strangled her with a nylon stocking. He next went to the next room and found Lisa Levy. He bludgeoned her, strangled her, and bit the left cheek of her buttocks so hard it left a lasting indentation. He also tore off one of her nipples with his teeth. He then savagely attacked Kathy Kleiner and Karen Chandler, who both suffered serious injuries but survived the attack. A random car had pulled up towards the house, and the headlights had come through the window of the room where Bundy was, and he ceased and fled out the back door. Even knowing that the police were closing in on him after the attack, Bundy was unable to help himself. He continued to attack women in increasingly frenetic ways. In mid-February, he finally fled Tallahassee and drove west. He was stopped by Pensacola police officer David Lee when the plates on the VW Beetle he was then driving came up as stolen. The officer placed him under arrest and had no idea he had just collared one of the FBI's 10 most wanted men. Given that Bundy had escaped custody twice already, severe measures were put in place to ensure that he remained in custody pending his trial for the Chi Omega sorority house attack. In Tallahassee, Bundy was assigned counsel, and given the extremely high-profile nature of this case, his lawyers were actually able to move the case to Miami. Before we go any further, let's take a quick look at the interesting jurisdictional issue of state versus federal prosecution as it pertains to serial killers. At this point, Bundy had killed people in Washington, Colorado, Utah, and Florida that were likely known about. Most likely more in Idaho and Oregon and even Pennsylvania from his time at Temple University. So why didn't this just become a federal prosecution and let the federal government prosecute him for all of these offenses at once? Now that's a fair question. It has to do with how federal jurisdiction is triggered and when cases have to remain at the local state prosecution level. The federal government only takes a prosecution when the violation is directly of a federal law, or if the specific offense spans more than one state. The most common example of this is narcotics trafficking. The actual crime is trafficking, which, if the drugs start in one state but end up in another, triggers federal jurisdiction. Keep in mind that state prosecutions account for the vast majority of criminal prosecutions in this country. Federal criminal cases are actually a relatively small fraction. Looking at Bundy's case, there are no specific federal or homicide or assault statutes. Those are solely products of state penal laws. And Bundy's murders were all singular events contained within a specific state. Had Bundy abducted a victim, transported her across state lines, and then murdered her, that would have triggered a federal prosecution because the individual states cannot prosecute actions which occur outside the bounds of that respective state. But in every instance of what Bundy was charged with, the conduct was contained within the state's boundaries. This means that each state would have to prosecute Bundy independently. He would go to trial in any state where he was facing charges, and the states could not agree to get together and jointly prosecute. Once Bundy got to Miami, he made the decision to represent himself. The trial judge appointed 5 attorneys to represent him, led by veteran public defender Polly Nelson. But Bundy dismissed them all, and they were relegated to basically passive observers. They were still technically part of his legal team, but he controlled virtually every facet of his own defense. There is an adage in the criminal defense world that a man who represents himself has a fool for a client. You heard me discuss this a bit in the episode a while back on Dr. Death, Jack Kevorkian. You'll remember from that episode that there are a few types of people who elect to represent themselves in criminal trials. In Dr. Kevorkian's case, he had a message he wanted to convey. He knew that if he listened to his lawyers or put them in charge, that the message would be muted and wouldn't get out. And that was something he couldn't accept. so he decided to represent himself because the message was important. Ted Bundy wasn't there to deliver a message or present a manifesto. So why did he demand control over his own trial? I'll give you what I think is the answer, and then I'll explain why. I think Bundy knew that he was going to be convicted. He knew the evidence. He knew what he had done, and he knew he was not going to escape. One common trait among serial killers is their obsessive desire to relive their crimes. This revives that feeling of power and control that the crime itself provides. I think Bundy viewed this trial as a last chance to feel the satisfaction of reliving the murders and assaults he had committed, and one last chance to exert the power that he craved. Now, here's why I think that. Bundy did all of the witness questioning himself. He wouldn't even take input on strategy from his 5-lawyer trial team. He was a true psychopathic narcissist, albeit a very intelligent one. During the questioning, Bundy spent the majority of his time getting the witnesses to walk through every aspect and every detail of the crimes again. With the law enforcement witnesses, he would have them describe what the various pieces of evidence meant that the attacker did to the victims. But Bundy spent the most time with Kleiner and Chandler, the two women who survived. He made them go through, in excruciating detail, every second of their attacks, their fear, their pain, how they thought they were going to die. And Bundy very clearly was relishing every second of it as he was asking the questions. But Bundy appeared simply to enjoy hearing about the horror and terror the victims felt. He never tried to direct his questions to anything resembling a defense. He did not try to attack the version of events or the witnesses' memories. It was really hardly a true defense at all. But it did signify Bundy's need for power, to control, to be the individual directing the way that things would go. Most serial killers have discussed their obsessive need for control, and that aspect of their crimes is really what drives them. Bundy simply could not surrender control to his legal team. He could not accept a situation where he was not the one who made decisions about what was going to be done. He needed to exert that control on every facet of the trial where he could. I think this is what led him to relegate the appointed attorneys to nothing more than observers, and that this is what led him to fixate his questions on the victims and the exact aspects of their ordeals where Bundy was at the highest point of controlling them. The lead prosecutor in the case, a man named George Deckel, who went by Bob, was aghast at Bundy's conduct and made several objections. But the judge, the Honorable Edward Cowart, often found nothing legally improper about Bundy asking witnesses to recount their testimony again. Judge Cowart, for one, did seem to be mildly charmed by Bundy. Now, there are a few important things to note about this trial itself. 1. The Florida Ted Bundy trial was the absolute first nationally televised trial in history. Actually, it was the first internationally televised trial in American history. 250 reporters from 5 different continents packed into the Florida courtroom and overflow areas to document every aspect of the trial. TV cameras caught every minute of the entire circus. This was a great case to test with national news coverage and cameras because Ted Bundy was such an eccentric figure in the courtroom. Not only was his questioning bizarre, but his entire persona kept people interested. Bundy would often ignore what Bob Deckel was doing with a witness on direct. He would sit at the defense table reading Russian literature. Perhaps the most outrageous moment of the entire trial took place when Bundy put Carol Ann Boone on the stand to testify for him as a character witness. She had met Bundy long ago when he worked in Washington, and she followed him from Washington and moved to Florida to be close to him. Bundy, a former law student, was zealous about research, and he had looked up Florida law and discovered an odd loophole that a marriage declaration made in open court in the presence of a judge was a legal marriage if notarized contemporaneously. During Boone's testimony, he asked her to marry him. She accepted, and Bundy made the declaration to the judge. He had also arranged for a notary to be in court that day. So, under Florida law, Bundy and Boone were married from that day forward until they divorced in 1986. Okay, let's take a moment to discuss the trial evidence which Dekel presented against Bundy. Dekel called a Chi Omega sorority sister named Connie Hastings, who placed Bundy in the vicinity of the sorority house that evening. Bundy was living in low-rent housing not too far away, so this was useful but not terribly compelling, as he could have been seen just walking the streets near his apartment. Dekel then called Nita Neary, another sorority sister, who testified that she saw Bundy fleeing the house with a bloody piece of wood he used to bludgeon Margaret Bowman and Lisa Levy. Neary had sat down with a sketch artist and produced a picture which did resemble Bundy. Now, this was much more compelling, to be sure. Neary claimed she saw Bundy for a very brief period at around 3 a.m. as he fled down the back stairs and out the back door. The testimony of these two women could still leave some doubt. There was also the testimony of Kleiner and Chandler, but they testified they never really got a good look at their attacker. So Dekel decided to focus on the tooth imprint left on Lisa Levy's buttocks. He called forensic odontologists Richard Souveron and Lowell Levine to discuss the bite marks. Both concluded with medical certainty that the impressions left on Levy's backside matched Bundy's mouth. Now this we're going to talk about for a minute, because I actually did spend a bit of time doing some research on forensic odontology, and I want to share with you what I found. Every source that I have found on contemporary forensic odontology has been extremely skeptical of using bite marks in skin to match a person's dental alignment. The reason for this is, again, this is according to sources in the field and not me, that skin, or any other very malleable substance, is prone to warp or otherwise not hold shape to the extent that a true comparison is extremely difficult to make, especially using the technology available in the late 1970s. To get a true comparison, you need a substance which will hold form and give an accurate view of the precise sizes and alignment of teeth. But Souveron and Levine both testified that they were certain that it was Bundy's teeth which had made that imprint on Levy. Bundy then took the stand in his own defense, making a lengthy statement proclaiming his innocence. And on cross-examination, he told Dekel several times that it simply wasn't him. But he could not provide any convincing alibi or explanation of his whereabouts at the time that the attacks happened. He did, however, remain calm and relaxed. He made jokes during his cross and tried to exude the charm that had carried him through his entire life. But Bundy found that the charm, which disarmed people on the street and opened so many doors for him while blending into the general public, worked well with college co-eds. But the expectations for his behavior in a court of law were different, especially while he was a witness. The jury deliberation lasted under 7 hours before Bundy was convicted of all counts, both the murders and the assaults. During sentencing, Judge Cowart almost sounded sad. While he did note the horrific nature of the crimes, he complimented Bundy's clear intelligence and lamented that he never finished law school. He even went so far as to say that he would have enjoyed Bundy practicing law in front of him. Judge Cowart claimed that it was a tragedy to waste such talent. He then sentenced Bundy to death by electric chair. After his conviction, he was quickly put on trial again for the rape and murder of 12-year-old Kimberly Leach, also in Florida. According to prosecutors, after the Chi Omega murders, while fleeing, he had abducted Leach with a stolen van, raped, and murdered her. Eyewitnesses and forensic testimony were introduced, and he was convicted of that murder as well. While awaiting execution, Bundy spoke to several journalists. and ultimately to other law enforcement agents who suspected that he had committed murders in their jurisdictions, which they wanted to close out. Before he died, Bundy confessed to around 30 total killings. On January 23rd, 1989, Ted Bundy was delivered his last meal. Steak, eggs, hash browns, and toast. He never even took a bite. He was executed the following morning at 7:16 a.m. in the electric chair. His last words were, "Tell the jury they were wrong." In summation, the trial of Ted Bundy gives us little by way of insight into the merits of the prosecution's argument. They had good enough evidence to convict regardless of the defense. But the fascinating aspect of the circus that was Bundy's first Florida trial was Bundy's inability to let go of control. Multiple books have been written about the pathologies and mental illness which afflicted Ted Bundy. I'm not a psychiatrist. I'm not going to try and explain which wires in his brain got crossed. But as a lawyer, this case presents some very interesting insights into how control manifests itself and how it needs to be applied in the courtroom. In the episode on Jeffrey Skilling, the Enron exec, I spoke for a bit on how the prosecutor in that case controlled the courtroom by eliciting the evidence just as he wanted it, in the order he wanted it, and with the impact he was seeking. That was control with a method and a purpose, and it was effective. Good trial lawyers exert control over the courtroom and demonstrate their dominance through their mannerisms, their confidence, and their speech and tone. But they also use those tools in furtherance of their specific narrative and message. Trying to exert control for the sake of exerting control, dominance for the sake of dominance, will backfire in the courtroom. The real power in court is making sure that things go the way that you want them without making it look like you're trying to be the dominant power in the room. Jurors will gravitate towards confidence. It makes them think that the attorney knows what he or she is talking about. But they typically don't respond well to cockiness or arrogance. Bundy's attempts at charm while on the stand were likely not received as confidence, but rather as trying to make light of the fact that two women were dead and two more were forever traumatized. In short, it didn't help him. The truth is that even had Bundy let his attorneys run the show, the outcome is unlikely to have been any different. Bob Deckel just needed to be adequate to get a conviction here, and he was a skilled prosecutor. He didn't overtry the case, and he didn't let Bundy's antics get under his skin. He played the adult in the room and came across as the serious person fighting for justice for the deceased. And that's the real takeaway from this case. There is, obviously, way more to the life and serial crime spree of Ted Bundy that I can cover in 35-40 minutes, but this should give you a basic understanding of the preposterousness that his Florida trial was. And hopefully, you can see how his mindset, his obsessive need to control everything, permeated every aspect of his life, including his trial. Thank you, as always, to my audio engineer, Dan Townsend, who also did an amazing job with last week's co-hosted episode with Bob Gottlieb. If you're new to the show, I highly recommend you check out the episode on the Fred Korematsu case. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to the show. You'll automatically get new episodes every other week when they come out. Also, please rate the show on whatever platform you use, as that will help other people find their way over and maybe find a new perspective of their own. I, of course, welcome all suggestions on cases, topics, or discussions on just about anything listeners want to bring up. You can email me at insummationpodcast@gmail.com, tweet me at insummationpod, or you can find me at my law firm's website, robertcgottlieblaw.com. Until next time, I'm Paul Townsend. Thanks for stopping by, and I hope that you'll come back for more.